You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. A week off, a good week's vacation. Hope everyone had a wonderful, healthy, happy Thanksgiving holiday filled with friends and family and some bit of sanity. Yes, I know the Thanksgiving table can be treacherous territory with that crazy uncle or curmudgeon relative who just has to be on the Trump bandwagon, especially now. While the impeachment's going on, they are digging in even further. And look, not surprised, not surprised at all. But here again, hope everyone had a good holiday. I know I did. And look, I think and you need these moments where people just go, you know, I'm stepping away. Just stepping away. I didn't actually read anything of the news, and this is like a real shocker, for 3 whole days. I read nothing of the news. I said, you know what? I'm just not doing it. My son and I went away to Buffalo for a couple of days, saw the Broncos and the Bills play, went to Niagara Falls, spent a couple of good days doing that, came home, a little family time, good stuff. And you need it. You need to rejuvenate, recharge, re-energize, because this week, this week's going to be a rough one. This will most certainly be if anything, it'll be an interesting week. Because today you had the House Republicans who have they've now got a 123-page draft of their defense of Donald Trump. They're now coming up with a defense. Didn't have much during all of the hearings that went on. Didn't have much other than, there were no firsthand accounts, none, until there were. you didn't prove anything until they did. It's about corruption until they found out it was, pointed politically. Now in their report, they bring up some of the same old defenses that, doesn't prove anything. The Democrats didn't do anything to prove the allegations of bribery or extortion or high crimes or misdemeanors, except, if you listen to the testimony, they did. It was there. Their main defense, I think, comes down to, well, the Democrats just don't like what Donald's doing. And the deep state really doesn't like what Donald Trump is doing. And it's true. We don't want the Ukraine to fall into the hands of the Russians. And I thought that was a bipartisan thing. I actually thought that was something that, Americans didn't want. Evidently, Republican Americans are okay with it. Evidently, our Republican friends would not be upset if Putin were to take over the Ukraine. I think I have a problem with that. I hope most Americans, regardless of your party affiliation, see that as a bad thing. And over the next couple of days and weeks, we're gonna talk a little bit about Ukraine, why Ukraine's important, the corruption that the Republicans are focusing on, because another one of their key components is, well, you have to understand that Donald Trump had a genuine, and I love this, this sincerely held BS that they throw out. I have a sincerely held belief that he had a sincerely held belief that there was corruption going on. And, or as they put it, reasonable skepticism and genuine skepticism because of how corrupt Ukraine is. Never mind that there are actually Russian troops within the country breathing down the neck of the newly elected leader there. Never mind that. Never mind the fact that this was really about extracting a pound of flesh that had nothing to do with corruption, because there had already been investigations into this. And while I'm not defending Hunter Biden, while I think it's a sleazy thing that all politicos do, it's not illegal and it's not corrupt. It's immoral. It's unethical, but not illegal. And I think you go to that point, you go, it's wrong. I agree with. But to then say, okay, well, we're going to do something much worse. The most powerful man in the free world is going to use his power to extract a public statement of investigation out of another foreign leader who is literally under siege. for his own political gain. Because it's all it was about. It had nothing to do with corruption. Give me a break. This was about wounding Joe Biden. That's all it was about. It was about getting Zelensky on CNN saying, you know, we're opening up an investigation into the Bidens. That's all it was about. This doesn't... And every day I get emails from the Heritage Foundation and all these right-wing think tanks that say, oh, we need to know who the whistleblower is. The whistleblower has to testify. And I'm going, why do you need the whistleblower at this point? You got all the people who were there. You got people who were on the call. You've got Trump's transcripts. He released the transcripts. You can, as he wants you to do, you can read them. And you can see literally the quid pro quo that went on. Especially when you put into context of the people who testified, you know, 2 weeks ago that pointed out they knew. The Ukrainians knew that the money was being withheld until this promise was made. It doesn't take a Rhodes Scholar or, you know, a Mensa member to figure this stuff out. Pretty simple. When a dumb truck driver can figure it out, I think, or at least I hope, the really smart people that we supposedly elect to sit in Congress, I hope they can figure it out. Now, what's going to happen over the next couple of days, I guess on Wednesday, the House Judiciary Committee is set to open up their hearings. Evidently, we're going to get treated to four... Could you make this any less exciting? We're going to be treated to four, count them, four constitutional experts who are going to discuss the historical and constitutional basis of impeachment. I'm already falling asleep just saying that. But I think you have to lay the groundwork. And this is part of methodically laying that groundwork of this is what's important. This is why what we've laid out hits that level of high crime and misdemeanors. So you're going to have this Noah Feldman from Harvard, from the Harvard Law School, Pamela Carlin of Stanford Law School, Michael Gerhart of the University of North Carolina Law School, and Jonathan Turley at George Washington University Law School. So we'll see. The four of them will be, it's my understanding that Turley is going to be the guy the Republicans wanted. So, you know, you'll get a balance, and that's good. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. We'll see what articles of impeachment pop up, because guess what? They're coming. Now, there's no secret here. It's going to happen. He will be impeached in the House. It's a matter of, you know, does the Senate, with everything that comes out, do they do their jobs? Or do they continue to put their head in the sand and turn their back on some pretty basic questions? I mean, the big one for me, look, there's a huge one for me, and it has to do with Rudy Giuliani. You know, why is Giuliani the guy that Trump went to go around all of the normal channels of operation, all outside of all of our diplomats, all outside of all of our infrastructure? Why Giuliani? Why did we privatize the State Department and give it to Rudy Giuliani and his band of criminals? This Lev Parnas, I don't know if you've seen this Lev Parnas. Evidently, his lawyer just the other day, said that the Southern District of New York, I guess they were at a hearing, and he said that evidently this Parnas guy has tons of electronic information, tons of, you know, audio, tons of documents, tons of stuff, and actual physical documents as well on the five iPhones, the two iPads, what else? A Samsung device. They had taken, you know, a bunch of, you know, Macs, iMacs, iPads. They got all kinds of stuff. And this, again, is another reason why he shouldn't be doing everything electronically. They can find it. But, you know, this is going to be interesting to watch this rat scurry, because he doesn't want to go to jail. No. So, you know, throw Rudy under the bus. And I think all of this comes back to Rudy, because I keep coming back to, I've got a lot of unanswered questions. One of them, the first one being Giuliani. Why would you choose that guy who you know is going to go on CNN or go on Fox News or go on any of these cable outlets and say something really stupid? Why would you give him any classified information? You know, what puts him at that level? Other than he's a little shady and he's got a lot of shady operations going on. The big question that another big question I have, you know, when Congress was allocating this money, when they were going through the process of voting on and allocating this resource for Ukraine, how come the administration didn't bring this up? How come the administration didn't say, whoa, we need to make sure that, we're not quite happy. Now, understand, the lawmakers did demand that, you know, corruption be addressed, and they already decided that it had been addressed, that it met their standard. Now, the administration, maybe it didn't meet their standard, but guess what? He doesn't have the power of the purse. That's Congress's job. If he wanted to hold the money back, probably should have told somebody. Just kind of. And here's the thing, you know, when you had all of these people who were, their job was to ensure that that money was being allocated, asking questions, why didn't they get answers? If it really was about corruption, and look, okay, let's give Trump the benefit of the doubt. Let's say, okay, he really, a corrupt person like he is, would smell out corruption. You know, it's like one of those things, a criminal knows a criminal. You know, it takes one to know one. You remember that when you were a kid? Okay, so we'll just say our corrupt president knows another corrupt president. Let's just go there. So we've got our corrupt guy saying their corrupt guy is bad, and we're not giving him anything. And look, maybe that's true. Maybe he's got a special corruption sense, you know, like a spidey sense. You know, gets the hairs on the back of his neck tingles up, or, you know, whatever, the little mushroom stands, whatever. But maybe he's got this special sense, and he's decided that I'm going to hold this back. Why didn't he tell anyone why? Knowing he's surrounded by really bright people, constitutional scholars, you know, people like John Kelly who were saying, hey, don't surround yourself by yes men. You're going to get impeached, like he is. And why? You know, again, here's another question. You know, why did you hold the money secretly? You know, why was this, you know, this hush-hush? And then hurry up and move it forward as soon as the whistleblower came forward. So many questions that, you know, this administration isn't answering, other than to tell us that, well, you know, it doesn't rise to the level. Well, what does? Does a stain on a blue dress rise to the level? Because I seem to remember the Republican Party all tingly in the panties over the stain. And maybe it was because they didn't put it there. I don't know. But guess what? I didn't think that rose to the level. Then again, you didn't have Bill Clinton strong-arming a foreign leader into providing dirt on a political opponent. I mean, to me, it still comes back to that. So I don't even need to hear from the whistleblower anymore. I've heard from all the people who were there, the people who were surrounded by Trump, and even the people that the Republicans wanted. I heard them. So this week's going to be interesting as the House Judiciary Committee moves forward. I guess, you know, we're living history. We'll see where this takes us. But so much to get to. So it's going to be an interesting run up to the Christmas break. Breakneck speed, and we'll see if the House gets it done before Christmas. I'm kind of hoping they do. That'd be a nice Christmas present, wouldn't it? You know, everybody could wake up on Christmas morning and open up an impeachment present. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to have, you know, a new president for Christmas? You know, who's going to find me somebody with some musical talent? All I want for Christmas is a new president. How about that? So there's the marching order. Come up with that song. But lots going on this week. Lots to get to. Excited to be back. Looking forward to the coming week. And you know, this impeachment is going to be interesting to see where it goes. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Coree Pennebaker is going to be here to share some thoughts on today's Supreme Court hearing. Evidently, some gun stuff. First gun hearing, first gun case since 2010. We'll find out what was going on with that and why it's so important. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1859. That was the day John Brown was hanged in Charlestown, Virginia, in what is now West Virginia. He had been sentenced to death on charges of treason, murder, and insurrection for his role in the raid on the United States Federal Armory at Harper's Ferry. Brown and 21 abolitionists intended to seize the arsenal there, then build a free settlement in the Appalachian Mountains. From there, abolitionists and free people of color would wage a guerrilla war against the slave labor system throughout the South. Convicted on November 2nd, Brown resisted plans for rescue and prepared to die a martyr. And on this day, John Brown wrote his last statement. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done. He was marched out of the Jefferson County Jail through a crowd of onlookers that included Stonewall Jackson and John Wilkes Booth to the gallows where he was hanged. While many abolitionists distanced themselves from his actions, they defended him and memorialized him after his death. Frederick Douglass remarked many years later, "His zeal in the cause of my race was far greater than mine. It was as the burning sun to my taper light. Mine was bounded by time. His stretched away to the boundless shores of eternity. I could live for the slave, but he could die for him."
Oh, John Brown's body lies moaning in the grave. I weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured out to save. And though he lost his life in his struggle to free the slaves, his truth is marching on.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
John Brown's body lies moaning in the grave.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the first Supreme Court case, first hearing in front of the Supreme Court since 2010 on the gun issue, and it's one of these really curious things. As I was reading more about it, you had Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I wish her nothing but health for the next year. She's going, you know, what's left of this case? They got what they wanted. It's basically over. You got Sonia Sotomayor saying, you know, the city threw in the towel. There's really nothing left to argue over. They got what they wanted. The city of New York moved back on their restrictions of people moving guns around in the city. They got what they wanted. So what is this about? And I would argue it's about when you've got someone on the ropes, as they do, it's about taking them out. And it's about enraging the base, keeping them all wadded up and you know, all tingly in the panties and donating lots of money. I'm here to share some thoughts on why this case is going forward, what it means, and what can come out of it. I've asked our good friend Corey Pennebaker to come talk with us. Corey is a gun violence survivor, also a survivor fellow with Everytown. Corey, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, brother. Thanks for having me on.
So what are we hearing out of this hearing so far? I mean, as I said, from what I'm reading of it, you know, they got what they wanted.
Yeah, and that was before the case was even heard. So it's another incident where you have the gun lobby trying to expand gun rights or just, you know, do things that they know are fundamentally incorrect simply because they're on the ropes, like you said in your intro. They are on their deathbed at the moment, and they are clinging to life, trying to do anything they can. They're throwing darts at a dartboard, man, and it really what it boils down to. The city had already relented quite a while back, so there was no reason to bring this before the Supreme Court once the city had changed the law, or the state had changed the law. So at this point, it's just more theatrics and the gun lobby trying to do anything they can to hold on to relevance.
Yeah, but you know, again, you know, this is one of those moments also for me where I look at the current makeup of the court. And if I'm the NRA, if I'm the gun crowd, I'm going to want to push through as much as I possibly can and get as extreme decisions as I possibly can now, because I don't know that you get a much favorable court in the next term.
Well, see, but that's what I'm talking about, though, because they know not only is their brand dying due to their own internal corruption and the fact that America's finally waking up to the point where we want to see, and we are demanding that we have common sense gun reform. The NRA and the gun death lobby knows that they are not on the right side of history on anything. So what they're trying to do is take advantage of what might be perceived as a stacked deck for them in the Supreme Court. But it simply isn't going to turn out in their favor, because at the end of the day, despite how extreme Gorsuch and pass me a beer Kavanaugh is, things don't always work out like you might think they do. And I could see that the NRA and the gun lobby are trying to do anything they possibly can to expand gun rights, even when they know they can't win, simply because they need a lifeline at this point. But I think at the end of the day, we are not only on the right side of history, but we will definitely prevail.
Yeah, you know, I've had one of these conversations with a gun nut friend who, you know, says I have the right to bear arms, Second Amendment. And I said, well, you know, I have the right to life. I mean, I have the right to liberty. I have the right to not worry about you walking into a restaurant, dropping your gun and putting one between my eyes. I think, you know, there's got to be some common ground where you can have your rights to, you know, blow, to shoot things. And I have the right to not be one of those things that gets shot.
And I don't disagree. But I would argue that the majority of the country also agrees with that we need sensible reform so that we don't allow guns to end up in the hands of those who should not have them. That's a reasonable approach. That's not gun confiscation. No one wants to outright ban guns or anything like that. We want to make sure that those who are a danger to themselves or others don't have easy access to a gun. But you see, the gun death lobby are really, really good at marketing. That's really what it boils down to. They are able to sell people on this idea of fear that you have to be armed at all times or something bad might happen to you, while ignoring the fact that the majority of gun owners aren't trained enough to know how to operate those guns in a highly stressful situation. Think about the amount of training that is required for a police officer or a SWAT officer, right? Those folks go through an immense amount of training to a degree, and in some cases, police officers aren't even required to take that many hours of active shooting, to the point where you have a lot of unintentional shootings with police officers where they shoot the wrong person or they simply aren't able to get the shot off, right? So to think that we're going to arm untrained civilians and then give them this idea that just because they have the gun, they're automatically safe, and then they can save the day. This hero complex that we have fed into our society is deadly.
Yeah, because we've all seen the Rambo movies. We've all seen the, you know, the Die Hard movies. You know, one guy takes on the army and he wins.
Right, yeah, right. And that's why the movies, right? I mean, those kinds of things don't happen. I mean, we're not going to have the dude that lives next door to you all of a sudden turn into John J. Rambo, or he's Arnold Schwarzenegger or Carl Weathers. That doesn't happen, yeah. Right? But what we need to have is a conversation among the sensible folks among us about what responsible gun ownership is. And I believe, by and large, overwhelmingly, that gun owners are responsible and they want to be responsible. And when you have gun laws like background checks and all gun sales, red flag laws, you're keeping guns out of the hands of those who shouldn't have them, so those responsible gun owners don't actually have to use the gun.
Right.
I believe a reasonable person doesn't want to go shoot someone.
At least
they
hope.
Aren't anxious to go shoot someone. Right. But that's what makes them reasonable.
Now, I've told this story a couple of times. You know, when I first moved to Pennsylvania and I got a job, you know, up in the northeast corner, I remember a guy telling a story about he had just bought a new gun. And it was probably the most pornographic story I've ever heard of, you know, him whipping out his big gun and sticking it to who this, you know, this fantasy robber. And it was, you know, just the detail he went into. You could tell he put a lot of thought and a lot of fantasy into this moment. And I looked at him, I go, you're the last person who should have a gun.
Right. And I mean, and we shouldn't fetishize gun ownership, right? You know, we shouldn't be having those kinds of conversations where we're romanticizing gun ownership like that. If you believe that gun is a tool to keep your family safe, awesome. Right? Be responsible with it, keep it locked up, and keep your ammunition separate so that children can't get access to it, so that someone who is a danger to themselves, like my mom was, doesn't get access to it. That's okay, fine. But when you get to the point where you're being extreme about it and you can't wait to use it, you are looking for a situation to use your gun, that's how these problems start to happen. When you get people who claim to be responsible gun owners leave their guns on the table when a kid gets access to it or someone else gets access to it, or they leave a gun in their car gets robbed, now another bad person who shouldn't have a gun now has one. These things happen more frequently than they are stopping an assailant.
Yeah.
But they want to ignore that part. They actually don't care about stopping gun violence, and that's a shame.
The other part of it is, you know, we always hear this frame of, you know, the good guy with a gun rushing, you know, the hero thing you've been talking about. I remember, you know, years ago when I was in college, I had taken a private police course. I wanted to be a security guard so I could study at night. And I remember they had, you know, a guy come in from the state police to do the firearm training. And he the statistic he threw out, I think it was like, you know, like at the time, like, you know, 50% of all police involved deaths where a cop is killed on the job is with his own gun within 3 feet. And, you know, it's one of those things where he said, look, the last thing you want to do is let anybody have access to your gun. And in fact, he told us, you guys don't even want one. Because it just makes the situation that much more dangerous. Because guess what? The second you pull it out, you better be ready to use it, or someone's going to take it from you and use it on you. And it's one of those things that, you know, when talking about that hero complex, it's always stuck with me because, you know, at that moment I had to confront, would I be willing to shoot somebody? And, you know, and that's a question that, you know, hopefully I never have to answer. But, you know, it was one of those things that at that moment I'm thinking, you know, do I even want to have this gun?
Right. I mean, think about the awesome power that comes with having a tool in your hand that enables you to take someone's life or take your own life. We shouldn't be haphazard about that. We need to take this extremely seriously. And it's just unfortunate to the point where we are allowing the lowest common denominator dictate the conversation, which is, I'm glad now that you've got all these different organizations with Moms and Men in Every Town, all these other local organizations and other nationwide organizations like Giffords and the March for Our Lives students who are standing up and saying, we aren't accepting this status quo anymore. Too many folks have died as a result of gun violence. And it's time to have a counterbalancing voice in this conversation that is going to speak some truth to power. That is not going to tell a story that is littered with lies and fear. That's what they want to do. And this idea about the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Tell them about Pat Mache. Pat Mache is this little old lady. She's, you know, she was in the Tucson mass shooting when Gabby Giffords was shot and thankfully survived. It is Pat Mache tackled the shooter. Pat Mache wasn't armed, right? Now, when I tell the story in front of her, she gets embarrassed because I literally call her my superhero. She is, to me, a living, breathing superhero. She should not have had to do that, right? But she did it and didn't do it with a gun. And that happens with some regularity. And I think if we can literally get past the point where we allow this conversation to be cloaked in controversy, or that it is too difficult to have, or it's right or left, then we can get beyond this. Because when you really boil this down, there is no such thing as a Democrat solution or a Republican solution when talking about gun violence, because the bullet doesn't care. The bullet didn't ask my mom before it exploded her head, are you Republican or Democrat? This is an issue that is life or death, and it depends on every single one of us deciding that partisanship should go to the side and that we literally want to save people's lives.
Yeah. You know, I look at the one of the more recent shootings, and, you know, I don't know if it was the last one. We have so many, but the one in Santa Clarita, California, where this 16-year-old kid, who I don't think they've still figured out why, somehow got access to a gun. And it's another one of these situations where I go, you know, there are some common sense things that have to be done. I mean, you should be responsible for your gun. I mean, you know, someone should be locked up. That gun was somebody's. It got into that kid's hand somehow. There's got to be a way we stop that.
Right, and I believe in that case, that kid had, it was a ghost gun. So it was untraceable. It was someone assembled that gun rather than buying one from a store. And even in that situation, right, there was a prior incident with his family, with his father, with a gun that were removed from the house. So red flag law was able to at least stop something from happening a couple of years ago. But that's another situation where we need to prevent the access by children to any kind of weapon, whether it's a handgun or a long gun, especially without being supervised. And ghost guns should not be able to be mass-produced like that. But again, these shootings continue to happen.
Yeah.
And we have a case in front of the Supreme Court that shouldn't have been there. We should be talking about background checks, keeping guns out of the hands of those who should not have them, sensible things that are going to save people's lives. But if you were having this conversation because you have some extremists who just want a day in court just because they think, hey, I got to cling onto life any way I can because my issue is a dying one. We need to save people's lives, and I believe that there are more and more of us that are waking up, more and more people who are running for office on this issue, more and more people talking about this issue. We will win. It might take a minute, but overall, I believe we will win.
Yeah, but here's the thing that keeps getting thrown back at me. You're not going to prevent all of these. And it's one of those frames that's almost kind of defeatist in my mind. Of course, you're not going to stop all of them, but you're going to stop some of them.
Right. I mean, since when do we apply an absolutist or 100% record for any law? We have speed limits, right? But you still have people who speed. But if you look at the driving experience has been made safer because they took steps between the government and the auto industry to make the driving experience safer. You have windshield wipers. You have airbags all over the car. The way the roads are built is different. Street lighting is better, all to reduce auto fatalities and accidents. So much so that you have, in a number of states, a lower auto fatality rate than you do a gun death rate. We can do these things. We just have to have the courage and the desire to want to do it.
Yeah,
I think we're getting to that point, but it's just going to take a minute.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a partnership to be had with the gun industry? I mean, you know, there are some people who are so vehemently opposed to guns and the gun industry. Do you think that there's a – because, look, I know there's technology out there, you know, fingerprint technology, that you can, you know, load your fingerprint into the lock on your gun and within, you know, just a touch of the fingerprint, it unlocks, but only for that person. I mean, that seems like a common sense first step.
Right. It's a common sense. That is a common sense idea that the NRA decided they didn't want to have happen. Right? There was a law in New Jersey where they were going to make sure every gun that was sold after a certain period had to have some sort of fingerprint ID or ID capability to it. The NRA shut that down. They are extreme, and their only motive is profit, not reducing gun death. It is pure profit. And when you inject profit into a life and death situation like this, actually it's worse than the pharmaceutical industry. But when your main objective is to make money, you can't expect them to be like, well, we want to be altruistic and do the right thing. Although they have every opportunity to do so, they actively choose not to. But that's why we're here. Right.
Yeah, and I would argue that
we
the case
handle balance of the conversation.
Right, I would argue a case like this is designed to scare people. Oh, they're coming for your guns. Go buy more. You know, kind of like they did all during the Obama years.
Right. Again, it's marketing, right? They'll use anything they can to gin up fear just so more guns can get sold. And this idea that you buy a membership to the NRA, no, that's not where they're getting their money from. They're getting their money from the manufacturer.
Yeah.
So the more money that is generated from gun sales, the more money that the NRA ends up getting.
Good
That's
point.
What this boils down to. All they want to do is to make you so afraid that you have to go buy more guns. If you really play it through like a thought process of marketing, it's a cyclical conversation. If you have a gun, now I need a gun. And the person next to me needs a gun. And then the person next to them needs a gun. Now you have four people with guns now. Right? Four guns I got sold. That doesn't mean our lives are better. That doesn't mean society is safer or those households are safer. Just more guns got sold. That's it.
And one of those four has an arsenal, so look out for him.
Right. Yeah.
So
I mean,
last question I've got
America
for you.
America owns all the guns.
Yeah.
You know, that's ridiculous.
I'm with you. So last question I've got for you. Where do you see this case coming out? I mean, obviously, I think, you know, sadly, John Roberts is now considered the swing vote on this. How do you see Roberts deciding this?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I've never been one that's been able to really predict how the Supreme Court's going to work out because we've been surprised a couple times. But I honestly believe that the plaintiffs in this case don't have standing. I think that's what it's going to boil down to. I don't think it has anything to do with what they actually want. I think the fact that Burke has already changed the law, they no longer have standing.
Right.
And I think it'll get thrown out based on that. That's what I mean. That's what I think will happen. But when you have past Mayor Kavanaugh and extremist Gorsuch on the bench, I mean, and then, you know, Clarence Thomas, I mean, who knows what these guys might do? But at the same time, I think they know what their job is, and I think ultimately they'll say, hey, there's no standing here for this case.
Yeah, and you didn't even mention the guy who I think is worse than all of them. That's Samuel Alito. So that tells you how bad things are. But, Kerry, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. As always, great stuff.
All right, brother. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Our good friend, Kerry Pennebaker. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 2001. That was the day that energy trading giant Enron filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It was the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history up to that time. At its peak, the Houston-based Enron was the seventh largest company in the country. A combination of mismanagement and all-out greed sank Enron. The company used numerous accounting tricks and loopholes to hide billions of dollars of debt from its shareholders. In August of 2000, shares of the company were worth $90.75. But by November 30th, 2001, they had plummeted to just 26 cents. After filing bankruptcy, thousands of Enron employees were left to go down with the ship. Many employees and retirees had thousands of dollars worth of Enron stock. Employees were told the company would recover. They were encouraged not to sell off their stock and even to buy more, while at the same time, top executives were dumping their stock holdings. When the company went under, the employees' retirement accounts were wiped out. Some who had already retired had to re-enter the workforce. The following January, a New York Times report shared the stories of some of the 4,000 employees laid off in the immediate aftermath of the bankruptcy. One was told he lost his job by voicemail. Another was told he had 30 minutes to clear out his desk. Multiple lawsuits won a portion of the money back for Enron stockholders, but the employees lost more than $2 billion in retirement funds. In the end, more than 20 top executives were found guilty for the crimes they committed while running the company. Enron became synonymous with the corporate greed that has been the hallmark of 21st century America. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So if Donald Trump is so concerned about corruption, maybe start with the Republican Party. You know, he is the titular head of the party. He's the guy, man. He's it. He's at the helm, and driving them, you know, right into the ditch, by the way. But you know, lots of corruption there. And here, I guess tomorrow, I've been waiting for this. Duncan Hunter is going to plead guilty to one of the 60 charges that he's currently being charged with. That should land him in jail for a bit of time. You know, and I can't wait till Thursday to talk to our friend Bob Ney about what he thinks that Duncan Hunter should get. You know, Bob went to jail for 2.5 years for not putting a $6,000 expenditure on his expense report. At least that's what I remember. He'll explain it Thursday, I'm sure, better. But it was just, it was basically a clerical error. He did 2.5 years for. Duncan Hunter, evidently, according to his, I guess, ex-wife, because I guess she's down the road now. Who she served as his campaign manager. I guess maybe they are still married. I'm not actually sure. Because this is one of those just, you know, you couldn't write a worse story than this. Evidently, they blew about $200,000 of campaign donations on, you know, basic family things. You know, like taking vacations, buying gas for the car, putting groceries in the fridge, school lunches. You know, you wouldn't want the little hunters going to school with a negative balance on their cards and then having to eat a bread sandwich and be humiliated. No, couldn't have that. We'll use the campaign cash. Actually, use campaign cash to pay for dental work. And you go, okay, I get that. You know, you need to have good teeth to run for Congress. Sure, why not? I guess you can justify anything, but they blew about 200 grand is what the wife, this Margaret Hunter, has admitted. Now, this is what she's admitted to. So it's like, you know, when the kid eats the cookie out of the cookie jar and you catch him with a handful. I just had one. Or as my friend the cop used to say, every person he ever pulled over for DUI just had two beers. But, you know, they fell out of the car. So, you know, they're admitting to 200,000. I'm thinking jacking that way up. But evidently, he's going to plead guilty to one count. His wife also pled guilty about 6 months ago to one count, which they're saying would get her about 5 years. Now, obviously, since she did plead guilty and agree to testify against her husband, I'm sure she will get a reduced sentence. And I'm sure he's going to spend far more time in prison than she will, and rightly so. Anyway, he came out with this statement, which I just thought was really kind of comical. And, you know, so political. He says, the plea I accepted is misuse of my own campaign funds. No, they weren't yours. They were the campaign's. I think right here in your first sentence is your fundamental misunderstanding of how this whole thing plays out. That is money to be used for a campaign. You know, paying staffers a reasonable wage, making sure that they got health care, you know, that kind of stuff. Not so you can go to Disneyland. Just kind of throwing out. He said, of which I pled guilty to only one count. I think it's important that people know that I did make mistakes. I did not properly monitor or account for my campaign money. I justify my plea with the understanding that I am responsible for my own campaign and my own campaign money. Because understand, originally, he was tossing the wife under the bus. It was all her doing. She was the campaign manager. She was in charge of the cash. And yet, he was there too. What he failed to mention is that he had spent, I guess, a boatload of money on his mistresses. And that's what got the wife kind of... And there's part of me that goes, you know, the scorned wife... actually probably turned him in. Probably called the local newspapers. Hey, he's misusing campaign funds. Go get him. I don't know that to be true, but you know, hey, hell hath no fury. Now understand, you cannot use campaign money for those things. You can't do it. You could pay yourself a salary, which I encourage people who run for office to be able to do. There should be some balance. Now, as an incumbent, you can't pay yourself anything because you're already making 175 grand a year as a congressman. So, you know, this is one of those things where, again, the corruption just in the system here, maybe we should worry about our own corruption. Just kind of throwing that out there. Now, I'm kind of hoping he gets, you know, the full 5 years plus. The interesting part about this is the Daryl Issa is actually thrown his name in to run for this seat. And you may remember Grand Theft Issa as the guy who Mike Levin beat in the 49th in California. Evidently, you know, multimillionaire Issa has moved to the 50th, where now he's going to seek election. And for those who don't know, you know, Grand Theft Issa is the guy who developed the car alarm system. That's how he got to be so wealthy. And it's one of those things where, you know, how I said a minute ago, how, you know, our corrupt president might know another corrupt president. And this is where a criminal, a car thief from Cleveland, which is what it's been reported that Daryl Issa was, figured out how to stop other car thieves from stealing cars, and that's how he made so much money. Again, takes one to know one. My crook is better than your crook. So this crook is going to evidently be running for another crook's seat. I mean, isn't that just... it just reeks of irony. And, you know, you look at the things that the expenditures that they, you know, private school for the kids, video games, you know, I think if I remember right, the most egregious of the spending was they blew $500 to fly the family's rabbit, Egbert, across country. $500. Hey, look, hey, look, unless you, you know, there's no justification. I guess maybe if it was in the campaign photo, maybe you could, I don't know. I can justify a lot. I don't know about $500 to fly a rabbit across country. I'm just saying. The dental work, you know, I can almost, you know, you need to have straight teeth in the picture. You know, the private school tuition, the kids, you know, they're going to want that seat like you got daddy's seat. Because evidently, Duncan Hunter Sr., you know, not the one who's going to be going to jail, but the father of the one who's going to jail, evidently he held that seat for 14 terms. So 28 years there, plus all the years that little Duncan Jr. was there. You know, that's a legacy seat. You know, kind of like the Schusters here in Pennsylvania. Good luck in prison. Good luck, Duncan. I'm not doing the deliverance. I am not doing the deliverance. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2009. That was the day that Walmart agreed to pay $40 million to over 87,000 current and former employees in Massachusetts. This was the largest class action settlement in the state's history. The lawsuit, filed in 2001, accused the retail giant of denying workers rest and meal breaks. The company also allegedly refused to pay overtime, manipulated time cards, and required workers to work off the clock for free. In other words, Walmart was accused of wide-scale wage theft. The retail giant decided to settle the case rather than take it to trial. That was not too surprising, since the company had already settled 63 similar federal and state class action wage and hour lawsuits. The total tally Walmart paid out due to wage theft was a whopping $900 million. Under the terms of the Massachusetts agreement, any person who worked for Walmart from August 1995 to the settlement date received a payment between $400 and $2,500. The company was also required to put measures in place to ensure that wage theft stopped. This included a hotline that workers could call anonymously if they were made to skip meal breaks. Walmart also agreed to use a clock-out, lockout program that prevents workers from using store cash registers if they are not actually clocked in for work. In an affidavit filed with the settlement, the lead counsel for the employees said the accord dwarfs settlements of similar class actions against Walmart across the country. Not surprisingly, the company has strenuously resisted all efforts by its store employees to join and form unions. Wage theft, not getting paid for all of the hours you actually work, continues to be a major complaint of low-wage workers and is an important issue for today's labor movement. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So does it feel like it's getting harder and harder to make ends meet? Does it feel like all those jobs that are being touted as the wonder of the economy are just getting crappier and crappier? Well, you're not alone. Things are getting crappier. It's getting worse. And it's one of those things where finally someone has decided to come up with a way of measuring this. Evidently, this group, the Westward Capital, along with Cornell University Law School, the University of Missouri at Kansas City, the Coalition for a Prosperous America, and the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, they've come up with this job quality index. It's not a matter of just quantity jobs. And I've been saying this for a long time. Yeah, we can create millions of jobs, but if they pay a buck an hour, or in this case, $7.25, which might as well be a buck since the minimum wage hasn't gone up in over a decade, what good is it? What good is it to have a bunch of crappy jobs that people can't afford to live on? Well, they've come up with this index, and they've gone and they've done some historical data, and they've crunched some numbers and done a whole bunch of stuff where they're asking the question of what kind of jobs are we creating. So this quality index that they've come up with is set at indexes below 100 means we're creating more lower paying jobs. Anything over 100 means, hey, good, we're creating more higher paying jobs. And why is this important? Well, they went back a bunch of years, and they did, evidently the drop started in 1990 when they said that, 94 of every 100 jobs, or 94 of every 200 jobs were good paying jobs. So, 94 were high paying for every 100 low paying jobs. And that over time has continually gone down and down and down to the point where we've gone from creating 94 high paying jobs to every 100 low paying jobs in 1990 down to 80, what they consider, reasonable jobs. And according to the Brookings Institute, there just aren't enough good jobs to go around. Everyone says, the best anti, the thing I agreed with Reagan on, the best anti-poverty program is a good job. And I would amend that to say a good union job. But what the Brookings Institute found out is that 44% of all people who work in this country are low-wage workers. These people make somewhere around 18 grand a year. And I'm just trying to put my head around, How do you eke out an existence in this country on 18 grand a year? I mean, it's really quite incredible when you stop and you think about it. And, you look at, these indexes, you look at all this stuff, and understand, we know this. They're just putting numbers to it. Academia is trying to figure this out. Because understand what we've been told our entire lives. We've all been told, the economics 101. The big giant X, supply and demand. As supply tightens, there's a scarcity, and the costs go up. So the more workers that are available, the fewer jobs that are available, the lower the wages. The fewer the jobs, the more the plentiful jobs and the fewer workers, wages go up. We're led to believe that a growing economy will get us higher wages. That just hasn't happened. And the jobs that we're creating are really low-wage, crummy jobs with virtually no rights whatsoever. And for me, as a union guy, it always comes back to, it's the union, stupid. It's the union jobs that we don't have, stupid. Because understand, back when I started working, you go back to the 80s, one out of every five workers was a member of a labor union. It's now less than one in 10. And understand, the reality, union jobs equal higher wages, better health care benefits, better retirement plans, job security, and some bit of a voice in what you do. And the weird thing is we've almost gotten accustomed to being powerless and living in desperate poverty conditions. And even if you're not actually in poverty, you're struggling just to stay on the treadmill. I know people who can't take a day off because if I miss a day's work, I'm not going to be able to put food on the table. And look, we've seen the numbers. 40% of the people in this country cannot come up with $400 in an emergency. 60% can't come up with $1,000. To me, that's just maddening. And yet, we're not pushing our politicos to address the income inequality problems in this country, which comes back down to the distribution of wealth. So when every one of those T-twits, you know, during 2010, 11, 12, were yelling at me, going, you want to redistribution wealth, you socialist. And I'm going, yeah, I want to redistribute wealth the way it was when I started working, where you made a good, decent wage, where your work was rewarded, where you could support a family on a single income. You didn't have to have two, three, four, five jobs to support a family. Where we are right now is insane. And it's getting worse every day. So when you see the, you know, the quality index, you know, telling us, yeah, there are more crappy jobs than there are good jobs. We knew that. Tell us something we don't know. Tell us how we fix this. Because I've got the idea how you fix it. You revisit our broken labor laws, and you give people the ability to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions by joining unions. And you have a government structure that encourages that. And we end all of this, you know, this misclassification and this gig crap, and we fight outsourcing. I look at the University of California right now. Evidently, the sixth time over the last 3 years, you've got, you know, people at I guess it's what, 10 colleges and five hospitals who have walked out on a one-day strike. You know, thousands of members who have taken to the picket lines. And what are they fighting against? Outsourcing. And you go, well, you know, why are they fighting for that? Well, because, you know, all of those jobs that, especially in this industry, you know, education and healthcare, you know, all of those low-wage jobs are getting worse. The union raised those up, you know, the janitors, the security guards, the parking attendants. Those are all jobs that need to be done. And yet you've got the University of California going, oh, we're going to outsource all that stuff. And it got me thinking about my local school district, you know, who first they lunch lady outsourced. They got a private corporation in there. Then the janitors went. Then I think the teacher's assistants, and then the substitutes. And you go, who's next? Someone said to me, go, well, how do we outsource, you know, the administration? I go, well, that's what charter schools are. Only they do it for profit. These are all things that lead to income inequality in this country. And you look at the fact that, you know, the University of California, evidently the third largest employer in the state, is actively seeking to drive down wages for, you know, thousands of workers. And what does that mean? That means, well, most of those workers then have to go to the state and seek, you know, food stamps or housing assistance, or, you know, go down the list of programs that are then accessible to low-wage workers. And rightfully so. Now, that's just a massive redistribution of wealth from the people who should be paying them to the taxpayer. Corporate America has been doing this for years. You know, this is not new. And what's frustrating to me is I've been screaming about this stuff. You know, Walmart's been doing it forever. All of these big giants have been doing this stuff forever. You know, you look at GM. You know, when the GM strike was going on, we had Frank Hammer on who said, well, you know, what they've done is, you know, there are different departments and they have different contracts and, you know, they're still unionized, but they're different tiers. Now, a lot of these employers got to get away with it without contracts. So they end up pitting people against each other. And, you know, again, this is another one of those weird moments where, you know, the economics profession has come up with a phrase for it. It's now a fissured workplace where you have all of these independent contractors, all these subcontracting groups, and all these third-party logistic companies who are doing all this work so that you don't organize. A couple years ago, we talked to somebody from California, because California, I think it was Rolls-Royce, the parts, the people who, you know, supplied the parts to all the, you know, all the dealerships around the country, the warehouse, was unionized. So what did the company do? They brought in a third-party logistics company, Bob's Logistics, and wanted to fire all of their employees to bring in this third-party logistics company. That if eventually they ever organize, they go, oh, well, we're just not going to renew your contract. Bring in someone else. And what's the goal in that? Again, lowering wages, making those jobs that had been good, solid, family-sustaining wage union jobs down to poverty, desperation jobs. That's been the corporate game plan for decades now. And what's I guess, you know, frustrating to me is I've been talking about this for 14 years on this program. This is not new. We've known this stuff. The question is when do we finally have the wherewithal? When do we finally say enough is enough and fight back? That's where I'm at. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.